Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the tragedy in the south of Russia, where upwards of 300 to 400 young children, mostly, were killed. And it was clearly a botched operation in terms of a rescue attempt. And we'll look into the broader issue of this agony that's going on in Russia, the endless Chechen war, the second Chechen war, as it's called, whether there's any kind of end game here. We'll be speaking in a moment with Nina Khrushcheva, who teaches international relations at the New School University in New York and was recently visiting in Russia. And we'll then talk about the Israeli spy case involving Larry Franklin, who's a analyst at the Pentagon, a specialist on Iran, who is now under investigation and is apparently cooperating with the FBI. But news reports have indicated that his activities, or at least the documents, the presidential directives that he's accused of passing to the Israeli lobby AIPAC and then on to Israel. We'll talk with Avner Cohen, who's a visiting professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's the author of Israel and the Bomb and a new book, Israel's Last Taboo. And we'll also have on Michael Saber, who is an international business consultant and the author of the Armageddon Network. And Michael Saber, back during the Carter administration, prompted an FBI investigation into an official with the Senate Foreign Relations Commission Committee, Stephen Bryan, who he witnessed in a coffee shop in the Madison Hotel passing documents to Israeli diplomats. So we'll look into the history of whether or not Israel has an active espionage program here in the United States. And Nina Khrushcheva, you were recently in Russia, and obviously this is a major trauma and tragedy. I've seen some television coverage of the Russian people getting not exactly the full news story, very edited and somewhat sanitized pictures. I believe we're getting more of the true horror of this incident here in the West. But nevertheless, how does Putin navigate the fact that this is his second Chechen war? He said he was going to do a better job, and it looks as though he was actually forced a couple of days ago to issue some kind of mea culpa.
Hello.
Hello, Nina.
Yes, I was just there, and summer in Russia is usually a very quiet time, and at the end of the summer, as you probably know, there's something blowing up or some crisis happens, so unfortunately this summer hasn't been.
Well, we've had two plane crashes and a bombing in Moscow.
Plane crashes and the bombing.
And now this...
The school disaster. And I was talking to various people in Moscow, and what they are saying is that, in fact, the plane crashes and the metro bombing next to the subway station bombing is not even mentioned anymore. I mean, the only thing that's being talked about is the school, which is understandable, but yet again, people have very short memory in that regard. We have to talk about the whole cluster of events that happened, because if we are indeed to discuss Putin's promises of how to make Russia secure and his sort of vowing to fight terrorism, then we have to remember that all these things happen in 1 week. And it is true indeed what you said, that here, when you read the news stories here, watch the news stories, there's always a memory of the plane crashes and the subway bombing, but there, almost not at all. So the press, I wouldn't even say that the press is censored in that regard. It's that as if the press censors itself, because obviously my family is in Moscow and a lot of friends all over, and I talked to them. They did know the story as well as we did. It's just the footage is slightly different because there's only one still picture being shown and not much commentary going on. In fact, the first when it all happened on the first of Wednesday, on the first of September, on Wednesday, Putin did go on TV, but he didn't go on TV to talk to the people. He did go on TV as a reportage of him meeting with his security forces when he just came back from the Crimea. So there was an idea that, in fact, he knows what's going on and he is trying to do something, but it was never a direct conversation. It was never sort of direct response to the people, be calm, be quiet, I'm on the story. It was sort of very far removed from what the as if from what the interest of the people are and from what the interest of the country is.
But he can't sustain that now, because even with a controlled media in Russia, the evidence, clear evidence that the security forces just blew it so badly, they screwed up so badly, they didn't have a cordon around the perimeter of the building, they didn't really have any medical emergency assets available. And furthermore, they allowed local townspeople whose children were being held hostage to arrive on the scene armed. And we don't know, but it looks as though many of the kids were caught and shot in a crossfire, or a three-way crossfire between townspeople that are armed, security forces that were panicking, and terrorists who were absolutely ruthless.
Oh, absolutely. You can't control. I mean, the idea of controlled media in contemporary world is obsolete. You can't do it. And that's why Putin did go on TV, but in sort of much more staged and centered form, which is a report on his meeting with other people. And he went to talk to his own population only on Saturday after he went to Beslan. And nonetheless, all the information is coming out, and all the information is being available to both the Russians and the world. So you can't successfully control it. And therefore, of course, somebody has to explain to him and tell him or his security forces that they would be much better off opening up the information. But we have to remember that this is a country of secrecy. Until 15 years ago, the whole concept of opening up anything was an oxymoron. I mean, it didn't know how to do that. So it is, I mean, if we do a comparison, it is better than it was, but, you know, it doesn't really matter for 400 people that died this time and another 150 that died over the last week, almost 150 died over the last week before that. So it is.
And then you've got to go back to the Moscow theater where 150 innocents died as a result, again, of the rescue attempt. When they pumped in this gas into the theater, and the gas, because it was a KGB product, was considered a state secret, and they didn't even inform the rescue medical people of what the nature of the gas was. So all of these innocents that were being held hostage by the Chechens died unnecessarily, because had the emergency services people been told that this was basically an aerosolized version of heroin, they could have given them this stuff called Narcan, which is what they give to junkies when they overdose, and it brings them back. So those people died unnecessarily.
Absolutely. But, I mean, it only confirms what the Russian state has been doing for centuries. I mean, it kills its own people. Even if it tries to save them, it kills its own people. And, you know, there was a hope that after the Dubrovka disaster, the theater disaster you just mentioned in 2002, something will be done. And yet again, as you very correctly mentioned before, even this very bad footage that was shown on the Russian TV, they were showing women, people gathering around the school, and the people in fatigues running. But you already, I mean, the level of incompetence was seen even on this, let's say, censored, it wasn't censored, I think, it was just very unprofessional.
Sanitized, perhaps.
Right. So, I mean, it was just basically they didn't know what to shoot, so they were shooting whatever scene was there. Even there, you could see the level of incompetence of the Russian of the Russian forces. The same thing with Dubrovka, and that's why it's even I want to use the word cynical, but it's not even cynical. I think it's almost inconceivable when Putin finally addressed the nation on Saturday, saying we underestimated the threat. I mean, what does it mean we ended? He has been fighting this war for 5 years. The Dubrovka happened in 2002, and they're getting only worse. He has been blaming corruption of the military forces. Didn't he know? I mean, I'm sorry to bring up the Khodorkovsky affair, Mikhail Khodorkovsky affair.
He's the head of the Yukos Oil, who is now being jailed.
So the justice comes when there is an oil businessman being prosecuted, but in terms of security forces, and Putin, indeed, if we remember, vowed to bring security to the Russian people, then all of a sudden we encountered corruption in 2004 during his second term. So it's all, I mean, I don't know how cynical he was in pronouncing that, but from an inside or an outside observer, this whole cluster of events, the whole concept of Putin's presidency is a very cynical one and is a very alarming one altogether.
Let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Nina Kusheva, who is teaches international relations at the New School University in New York and was recently visiting Russia. Of course, I think, Nina, you're putting a finger on the broader issue here, which I think is also not discussed in the United States, particularly by the Bush administration. After being terrorized by the KGB or the MKVD or the Cheka for 70, 80 years, the Russian people now have, you know, perhaps without realizing it, allowed the KGB to take over the country. Putin has a team of almost all KGB guys, and everybody that I talk to over there gives you more and more anecdotal information that the clock is being turned back. I think, tragically, this government here, George W. Bush, has been so preoccupied with Iraq that he has allowed Putin a free hand. To some extent, the European Union to put some pressure on him. But it seems to me like there's been a successful KGB coup in Russia.
Well, yes and no. Yes, obviously, KGB people do occupy the key positions right now, including the president himself. And no, because as we mentioned earlier, this whole thing is so dysfunctional that I can't even say that it is a successful KGB coup, because a coup allows or requires, the coup requires some sort of strategic thinking, some sort of understanding how it's going to function in the future. I don't see these people doing that. It seems just very random event happening, and ultimately the result is that there is a KGB coup happening. For what reason, though? I mean, what is it going to achieve? What is it going to do to Russia? What is it going to do for Putin? How would it serve Putin? That is yet unclear.
But isn't it, Nina, isn't it very clear that Putin is authoritarian? He doesn't like any criticism in the press. And one of the main reasons he went out after the young entrepreneur, the owner of Yukos, Khodorkovsky, and put him in jail, is that Khodorkovsky put money into an opponent's campaign.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's that simple. And you're right, it is all very clear, but it's also not clear. And I was just sort of going to continue. Yeah. What was unclear is that unless Putin doesn't plan to be reelected in 2008, then you are indeed right. And it is indeed a KGB coup, and it is indeed an absolute turning back. As for Khodorkovsky's arrest, because Khodorkovsky did put money into the opponent campaign, I think it was a pretext, actually, because the opponent he was supporting with money was of not serious consequences for Putin. I was talking when I was in Moscow this time. I was talking to very close to Putin, government official, very high-level government official, who I asked the same question: why? What did he do? It is ridiculous if Khodorkovsky is supporting Yavlinsky, the chair of the Yabloko Party, the Democratic Party of Russia, who is not popular politician in Russia, at least. I mean, very popular in the West, but not in Russia. Why does it matter? And this gentleman whom I talked to said to me, the boss said no to politics. It doesn't matter what kind of politics you support. I said no, you don't touch it. So in this regard, if Putin does indeed mean not to be reelected in 2008, then you're absolutely right. But I still would like to believe that Russia is not completely back in Stalin's time and Stone Ages and feudalism. I still would like to believe that there is some possibility of it moving forward instead of moving backward. But maybe, you know, being a Russian, I still don't want to, you know, give up all the things that my grandfather, Nikita Khrushchev, was struggling for, and then Mikhail Gorbachev, who I respect to no end, was struggling for, and Boris Yeltsin, who I started feeling much better about recently, because you can feel really great about Vladimir Putin.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, it seems, though, that that Putin is very popular. Obviously, the oligarchs are extremely unpopular, so to move against them is obviously a win-win for him. But absolutely. Is there a new kind of KGB cronyism? Are they going to renationalize these assets like Yukos Oil, or are we going to have a kind of form of KGB cronyism?
I think we already have it. I mean, and this the whole Chechen situation, the whole Ossetia, that's where Beslan village is, situation proves that. I mean, of course there is KGB cronyism. Of course there is security services cronyism, because how can on earth, this is their job to do operations like that, and they are highly incompetent. They paid money. They must be doing something. Something must keep them in the services. So it is going on. It's not yet again because of the secrecy that you mentioned and self-censorship of many journalists after all those sort of slight orders, never talk about things that I don't want you to talk about. I, Putin, don't want you to talk about.
Well, Nina, we should add here that those few courageous journalists who do oppose this government,
absolutely.
One of them was just poisoned on a plane trip.
Anna Politkovskaya.
Right, and one of them has disappeared, and another one was beaten up by hired thugs.
Absolutely. No, they are. I mean, but that's what's so dangerous, is that yet again, they are, all of a sudden, the country that declared free press and had free press, all the very responsible press, but nonetheless free, until a few years ago, all of a sudden they are on the par of dissidents of 1970s that were publishing things in Samizdat during Brezhnev's time. So that is kind of very, very dangerous, very dangerous trend. So they are some courageous people. But nonetheless, the trend is that we are going back to, you know, things that in 1991 we denounced.
Well, again, I'm very disappointed, to say the least, in the Bush government for not holding Putin's feet to the fire. Instead, George Bush, you know, looks into his eyes
and sees his soul. Because, you know, if we look at George Bush's eyes, I'm sure we'll see the same kind of soul who wants to be in Iraq for the sake of poll numbers. And it is indeed very dangerous, because when Dutch Foreign Minister Bernard Boots tried to actually say that we very sorry and it's horrible what has happened, but would be nice to know, would be good to know how indeed this disaster could have happened, he then had to go on TV and apologize because he wasn't sensitive enough, and Russia is going through this horrible tragedy. I mean, of course, it's a very legitimate question, especially with the European Union. It is a neighbor of Russia. It needs to know what is the future of Europe for that regard? If Russia is not capable of dealing with its own problems on its own, it probably has to involve the world. But in order to involve the world, you can't really keep secrets. You actually have to go open and show the operation, and you know, ask for training if you can train your own forces and so on. So, unfortunately, I know that was sort of the earlier question that you posed, is that what is the future? I see no future. I honestly see no solution for this conflict in Putin's times. And the only thing I see is sort of very similar to what the United States is hoping to do, is to more and more oppression and more civil liberties being crushed and more and more propagandistic slogans.
Yeah, but we don't have in this country, for example, if the state of Mississippi was populated by groups of radicals that followed Osama bin Laden, we would have a similar situation. I understand that more and more people in Russia, and Putin himself often likes to say that this is all about the global war on terror, and that in effect he's trying to borrow from Bush, and they immediately say that a bunch of these terrorists that were killed in the school disaster were Arabs. But
we don't know that.
Yeah.
But
even the Chechens in exile have been saying the same thing. There is evidence, though, that there's evidence that there are Chechens fighting in Afghanistan and in the border regions with Pakistan. There's also a fellow called Ali al-Walid, who's one of the Chechen leaders, who's a Saudi. And recently in Chechnya, there was some roadblocks were set up by rebels, and they hauled police and military people out of the cars and shot them on the spot. And this is Western reports saying that the killers said, this is how Wahhabis treat you, you know. Yeah, so they were boasting that they were Wahhabis. So there is clearly an element here.
Absolutely. I'm not dismissing the argument that they may be. I'm just dismissing the argument that immediately, with all the very little information coming from that school, the only thing the Russian security services knew for sure is that 10 people are Muslims.
Right.
10 people are from the Arab countries. I dispute only that, because that seems very opportunistic.
Right, as if these corpses would have Saudi Arabian passports on them, you know.
Well, exactly, they do. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that is my question. And if it is indeed true, talking about secrecy, tell me why. Tell me how you know, how you get to this information. And actually, and also tell me what the next steps in fighting the war on terror will be, because for now, Chechnya is far away, Ossetia is far away, Ingushetia is far away. All these places are very, very far away, and most of the time, Russians, those who live in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and sort of closer to European part of Russia, they don't think about that. And that's what, when I said that Putin is using it for his own political advantage. That, I mean, tell me, if we are fighting the war on terror, tell me what it entails. I want to know. Because it seems when things strike, all of a sudden we do. But most of the time, it's only on the level of rhetoric.
But there is, though, underlying this, the fact that it happened in Ossetia, which is a Christian enclave. Next door, Ingushetia is Muslim. Chechnya is Muslim.
Georgia is right there, and they have border disputes. They have territory disputes, which is not a religious issue because they're both Christian countries. But nonetheless, the border dispute in that part of the world is as important.
Right, and there's also another issue, which is the broader demographics of Russia, where you have one of the lowest birth rates in the world, a high rate of abortion, and a very high mortality rate for a Western, a first world country, second world country, whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. It's a very high birth rate. Contrast that with the birth rate down in the South, and particularly And you know, all the women who have the explosives strapped to them apparently are widows of guys that have been killed. So, are we heading into some kind of endless agony?
Well, I was trying to say earlier that I don't really see an exit because Putin doesn't seem to have an exit strategy, and the longer it continues and the less options Putin has or offers to the nation, the more Bogdan and Chechnya will get. I mean, I'm saying more. I don't know how worse it can get, because when it all started, there was a promise that there may be some solution. But we also have to remember that as horrible as what's happening in Chechnya, there's always an understanding of many countries, and actually the United States is not one of them, which is, I don't know whether it's positive or negative, is that originally Chechnya was fighting for independence, and then it was seen as a very positive development. The problem with this development today is, as you mentioned earlier, the fight is far beyond the independence fight. Now it's a Orthodox religious fight. It's the Muslim state that they want to have, which I'm not sure, as you mentioned. I mean, if Minnesota decides to become a Muslim state, I mean, what would be the reaction of the U.S. government? Probably not very positive. But I think, for example, in European reaction, there's always this belief that originally, because it was an independence fight, it must have some merit. And probably did have some merit in 1992, which today is outgrown and mutated into something that is far beyond that. And I think that is a danger, because a lot of people still see Chechnya and the Caucasus as an oppressed part of the Soviet Empire, which indeed it is. But there are a lot of other issues go into it, and this is another thing that needs to be solved. And God knows how this will be solved, because, as you remember, Chechnya was given a de facto independence in 1999, and then it became a safe haven for Wahhabis and Khattab and Bin Laden's militants. So, if the independence status is given to them, how can we make sure that the nation building indeed will happen there instead of military build-up?
But just finally, Anina Khrushcheva, it seems to me that what you're also saying here is that there is a sort of symmetry here between the United States's, or the Bush administration's reaction to the and its involvement in the war on terror, and the extent to which this can be used for domestic control.
Yeah,
because, I mean, clearly, after 9/11, Bush was confused for a couple of days, but then when he seized on the idea of a global war on terror...
Well, Cheney seized on that idea.
Well, but what it did to them was that it gave them a huge boost in terms of in effect, 20 million votes automatically, because you're a wartime president, and he has played that, and of course his entire campaign is based on that now, as we've seen from the Republican convention. So not that Putin was in anything but in control of that country. I mean, is it being played out as Russia's 9/11? It's, you know,
it is, and in fact Putin has been talking about the war on terror long before President Bush started talking about the war on terror and the Muslim danger. And I mean, Russia has been talking about it for centuries. I mean, the whole concept of Russia is the buffer between the East and the West.
All right, all you have to do is read Tolstoy's short story.
Yeah, I read Tolstoy, absolutely.
The Cossacks.
And all these things are being told in Russian literature 200 years ago. This is one thing, but the difference is, and it is being used, the difference is, and the reason I am not that confident that Putin will be very successful in, although he has been doing well so far, in using it completely, because Iraq is far, Afghanistan is far. I mean, of course they can't come here, but this is on Russia's territory. And because it is such a discombobulated country, very dysfunctional, very unprofessional in many ways, it's much easier to get through the borders, it's much easier to pose for somebody else, it's much easier and much closer. And that's why ultimately, unless it doesn't become a complete totalitarian state and Putin is not reelected in 2000, I mean, and Putin stays after 2008 when the new Russian elections are supposed to happen, then he will have to answer for this action.
But just in closing, Nina Khrushcheva, it seems to me that you're posing two extremely pessimistic scenarios. One is further military force in order to impose a military solution on Chechnya, which is probably impossible. And the other alternative, which is to give autonomy, which there was a brief window of that, and what happened then was the Wahhabis came in and became a safe haven for international Islamists. So it seems to me that the choices aren't very good. The hard approach is not going to work, and the soft approach is if it's based upon what happened in the early 90s, is counterproductive.
Unfortunately, that is something that I'm saying, and I mentioned it earlier, that I don't see any solution. The only solution I see, the same as I see the solution with the United States, is the world has to get involved, is that United Nations has to get involved, European Union has to get involved, secrecy should go, information should flow out, and it has to be a concept that the whole world participates in. That's the only way. I mean, the same as I see the solution for the United States with its own war on terror, because you can't fight the war on terror, and that this, in effect, both are wars on terror. Both countries are fighting alone because it is a global problem.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Nina Khrushcheva, who teaches international relations at the New School University in New York, and she is the granddaughter of the former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. I'm now speaking with Avner Cohen, who's a visiting professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and the author of Israel and the Bomb and a new book, Israel's Last Taboo, and also Michael Saber, who is the author of The Armageddon Network, and he's an international business consultant. Avner, you did a lot of work on the history of Israel's acquisition of the nuclear bomb, and of course that did involve a lot of, espionage, industrial espionage, or whatever it was. There was also a lot of covert cooperation from the French and others. Is there a link here between this idea that there's an Israeli spy network in the United States and the long-standing, networks that have operated in terms of the story that you've uncovered, the history of the Israeli bomb?
Well, historically, at one time, there was some various kind of loose connections in that area. Incidentally, some of them were even related to your own town, to Los Angeles. But I believe that this issue today is hardly in existence, and surely I do not believe it relates to the last burst of stories that seem, right, at this point, quite much ado for very, very little, if not nothing, that came out in the last week or so. So
it has not. This has nothing to do with technology. This is a political story. That, right, what the allegations are, that the documents that this Pentagon official, Larry Franklin, is alleged to have passed to APEC officials, who in turn are alleged to have passed them on to Israel, were, I believe, some kind of draft of a presidential directive on how to deal with Iran.
Well, my comments would be very much, I guess, like yourself, without following the press, without having any inside information about the specifics. But I do believe that on this issue, the issue of Iran, there is a lot of talks between Israel and the U.S. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that talks goes at all levels, from the level of President Bush and Prime Minister Sharon to the levels of working people at the embassy as well as at the Pentagon. And given the uniqueness and the special relations between the U.S. and Israel over the years, and it's almost within the family. And I believe that the U.S. law in many ways doesn't fit so well to such close relations. So all these rules about classifications and so far, without knowing any specific about what did or did not happen in that meeting between Larry Franklin and perhaps Israeli official. But I believe that there is some problems and perhaps on the side of the FBI to try to put the former law in the context of this close, long-standing relationship between Israel and the U.S.
Let me bring on
the question of Iran.
Sure. Let me bring in Michael Saber, who is an international business consultant and the author of the Armageddon Network. And Michael Saber, you were apparently in a coffee shop in the Madison Hotel in Washington, D.C. during the Carter administration, waiting for an appointment with a business associate. And you overheard a conversation at a table next door, and that prompted an FBI investigation. Can you briefly go through that, capitalize that story for us?
Yeah, that was over 25 years ago. It was the Madison Hotel, which is right across the street from the Washington Post. And Ezra Weissman, who was the defense minister at that time for Israel, was across the street apparently doing an interview. And by chance, was sitting in this coffee shop, and some gentlemen came in, and they all said shalom, and they were right next to me. And I looked up, and the one fellow was introduced as Stephen Bryan, who was with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time. And they sat down, and I didn't pay a lot of attention, but then they started a conversation, which I could hear very clearly. I finally took out my little pencil and piece of paper and started taking some notes. It was such a fascinating conversation. What I found most fascinating about it was Brian was with these gentlemen who were Israelis, I found out later. I had heard one or two of them introduced, but I wasn't sure who all of them were. And he was referring to himself, and he's an American, as and the Israelis as we, and the United States government, Carter, Brzezinski, etc., as they. We can't let them get away with this. They're going to try to hurt Israel's defense systems, etc., etc. So after about 45 minutes, they left. I didn't know what to do. I eventually reported it to the Justice Department. It opened up an investigation. One-year-long investigation, Brian was removed from his job during the investigation, and led to a recommendation on the part of the FBI and the Justice Department for it to go to grand jury for espionage for Israel.
I see. And so, and what happened? There was no indictments or no trials?
No indictments, just an investigation. I wrote the book about the investigation. I put the book back, put the pieces back together, and the book came out with a lot of documents. And your question to Mr. Cohen was interesting, because I was just going over those documents in the book, and one of the most important things was a document that was, Brian looked at the Israelis and said, I have the Pentagon document on the bases, which you're welcome to see, which turned out to be a significant part of the conversation that led to the espionage investigation. But in that document, according to the Freedom of Information Act, there was, and I quote, information on Iran. Information concerning Iran's armed forces would be extremely valuable to Israel.
That was a time when Iran was falling apart, wasn't it? The Shah was wobbly.
Right.
So what's the significance of this in terms of today's story?
Well, in fact, I was called by a reporter from the L.A. Times a couple of days ago. He said, gosh, there's some amazing similarities to this case and the case that that you were involved in 25 years ago. Overheard conversation in a restaurant, which was apparently happened with Mr. Franklin and some Israelis and APEC people. They questioned me, the FBI questioned me numerous times, and in the documents are all kinds of questions about APEC. And at that time, the head of APEC was Morris Amate, and his name was asked of me many times to see if by chance he was in the conversation or his name was mentioned. And then the LA Times reporter said, and by the way, there's another similarity. Stephen Bryan was represented by an attorney who really got him off on this case, I think, due to his connections, et cetera, inside the U.S. government. But that same attorney, Nathan Lewin, is the attorney for APEC in the case today.
So, Avner Cohen, do you think that there's any fire here with this smoke?
Well, it's very interesting resemblance. I agree that there is a certain resemblance, but for me the resemblance is very much, again, to show this very close, very incestuous kind of relationship between the two countries that makes it so difficult to put it within the context of the formal law. It's in my view, it's much closer to a relationship between the different American military services, say Navy and Marine. And when he heard Mr. Bryan talk about them, and we should not let them, it's the same kind of opposition that sometimes you can find between competing U.S. services about budget, resources, projects, and so forth, goodies, and so forth. I think it's simply indication of the special relations. And the FBI, who are formally in charge of protecting the law, it creates certain problems. And it's not surprising, in my view, that most of the time, except the unique exception of the Pollard affair, those investigations, there were many. I mean, the Stephen Bryant is not the only one. There were others. Ended with nothing.
Well, then tell me what we know what Israel and the United States share in common. Do they not share in common? What brings them apart and would require espionage? In other words, where does their foreign policy and objectives diverge to the extent that you would need to do espionage?
Example, two areas. The area of technology, for example, I mean, obviously Israel would like to get as much technology as it can. Sometimes the U.S. Would like to sell the technology, but not as to give the whole technology to Israel. Sometimes they have hesitations. So often there is competing commercial interests between various kinds of establishments within Israel and the U.S. So that's one possible area. On the question of Iran, obviously Israel is much closer to Iran, and Israel takes Iran as a threat to Israel itself much more seriously than the U.S. The U.S. has global interests, and their opposition to Iran are very much in global context. I think many of the hints that if nobody is going to take action against Iran, Israel may have to use, very much like the way it did about almost 25 years ago in 81 vis-a-vis Iraq, is indications about certain kind of pressure, tacit or not so tacit, vis-a-vis the United States.
So in other words, they'd be sounding, they want to know how the U.S. would react if Israel preemptively struck.
Well, it's much more specific to what extent we can coordinate things. I'm not talking militarily, but in terms of the whole politics of dealing with Iran, how aggressive the U.S. is going to be vis-a-vis the Europeans, what's the U.S. strategy to handle Iran. Obviously, the Israelis are very much monitoring and at the working level, or the legitimate diplomatic level, of how the U.S. Considers the Iranian issue, the Iranian nuclear issue. That's very important to Israel, and legitimately, Israel has, as states do, follow very closely what the U.S. think and how positions are being articulated.
Well, that's the blurred area, though, Mr. Cohen. I think I would agree with you. The relationship is incestuous. I've looked at this issue ever since those days and written about it and worked with other scholars and journalists who have written about it. But it's the blurred area where it moves from legitimacy to illegitimacy.
I agree that there is a blurry gray area between these two things. And
let me ask you, Michael Sabin, since you're a U.S. citizen. I think you told me your father was.
My father was Lebanese, actually born in the United States,
right.
But.
And your mother is Swiss, right?
Right, right.
And often one hears that criticism of AIPAC as being a very powerful lobby. I don't think anybody denies that it's an extremely powerful lobby and very influential lobby, but. The other side of the coin is that in politics, the race goes to the swiftest, and just because the Israelis are well organized and highly motivated and are very effective, doesn't mean that they're involved in illegality. And conversely, give me a sense of why it is on the other side, in terms of influencing. We know that Israel has a lot of influence in Washington. In terms of the Arab influence, why is there not a similar Arab organization like AIPAC that has similar influence? Because nobody can argue that there isn't some money on the Arab side. I mean, the Saudis have got a tremendous amount of money.
Well, I think in one case you're talking about a community of Arab Americans, for example, who are diffuse and many interests and, you know, come from many different countries in the Arab world and don't have a common goal, common stand. In the case of the American Jewish community, there's just overwhelming support for Israel, sometimes reasonable, sometimes not reasonable. But back to the issue of the difference of legitimacy and illegitimacy, Mr. Cohen said that, these cases haven't amounted to anything. Well, the reality is that Stephen Bryan was investigated for espionage, not for just being cozy with the Israelis, but for espionage. Granted, it was dropped. But so was Paul Wolfowitz, so was Doug Feith, so was were numerous others that were investigated. Now, cases were dropped, didn't get to indictment. The only case, as Mr. Cohen pointed out, that got to that stage with an admission of guilt was the case of Jonathan Pollard. Now, Pollard pleaded guilty, so there wasn't a court case.
Well, he was caught red-handed.
He was caught red-handed, but the reality here is that every single one of these gentlemen and others have top security clearances again. In their files are investigations for giving information to a foreign government and investigations that either are about espionage or border on espionage. That is illegitimacy in itself. Now, again, the cases were dropped, but how can these people continue to get security clearances? One way is they give each other security clearances. Doesn't really make any difference what's in their file. I have over 1,000 pages of Stephen Bryan's file, and he still has a top secret security clearance. It makes a difference as to who looks at that file and decides that this person should be given the security clearance.
So I believe there is something
that very few journalists are pursuing at this point.
Let me ask Abner about this apparent double standard.
Well, I disagree. I believe there is inaccuracies in what just being said. I do not believe there were formal investigations ever against Wolfowitz or against Doug Feith. There are a lot of claims about their neoconservatives, about various documents written when they were out of government that support Israel and their connections to the Likud. Much has been written about that. But I do not believe that there was ever formal investigation against these two. There were other cases, indeed, and I believe that even the name of Richard Perl was involved in one of them in some other cases, but not against this two particular individual.
Well, there are articles right now on the Internet by Stephen Green that through the Freedom of Information Act disprove what you've just said. But that's whether or not. The reality is, as you say, historically, the Justice Department person in charge of international internal security who investigated the case that I was involved in 1978 was quoted by the New York Times. He was essentially, his name was John Davitt, from the end of the Second World War through 1980, the head of espionage investigations. He said the second most active espionage service in the United States after the Soviets in that time period were the Israelis, with numerous cases.
Well, Abner Cohen brought up the neoconservatives, and there, on the surface, it would seem to me that there is some kind of intramural struggle going on here inside the Beltway between the neoconservatives and their apparent enemies in the uniformed military and in the intelligence professionals. You get the leaks on Chalabi. There seems to be, Abner, don't you think there's something going on here?
Yes, I do.
So give me a sense of what you think's going on.
Well, I think there is a lot of people who feel that the U.S. Professionals at the professional side of various intelligence organizations, U.S. intelligence organizations, at the State Department, who believe that the U.S. led to Iraq in a way that it shouldn't have led, and, of course, that the U.S., the integrity of the U.S. Intelligence community as a whole has been compromised in the Iranian, in the Iraqis' story. And obviously, Chalabi was a major figure in that. And some people wonder what led us to have that kind of complex and apparently not very, ultimately not very useful relations with Chalabi that we had. And some people believe that the Israeli angle is the answer to that. I don't believe so. But I think there is a certain sense of resentment among some professionals within the U.S. Intelligence and foreign policy establishment. I would also add that the Pollard affair, indeed, which Israel was caught red-handed, was a very traumatic case for the Israeli intelligence community and, indeed, for the Israeli political leadership. And as a result of that case, there was a formal decision at all levels of intelligence not to do any formal intelligence work in the U.S. Some stuff was done before 86, before Pollard was caught. I believe that decision has held today, kept very tightly, and my own view, and it's being shared by many, many people who knows the inside of the Israeli intelligence, is that no formal intelligence operations take place in the U.S., and indeed many people in Israel think that Israel does not need that kind of thing. The working relations are close enough diplomatic relations that you need to do any formal intelligence to work in the U.S.
So, Michael, what's your reading on the idea that there's some kind of a civil war going on inside of the Beltway?
Well, again, I interviewed scores of people involved in the Bryan case after putting it back together and going through the Freedom of Information Act. There is, I would agree to a certain extent with Mr. Cohen, there's a resentment in the part of intelligence agencies that Israel, in their minds at least, have been able to get away with more than just an incestuous relationship. But, walking into Senate office buildings, going into the safe, Israelis, Karen Kowatowski reported that this happened inside the Pentagon. Now, we're never clear whether those things are authorized or unauthorized, but it's there are FBI agents and intelligence people that think that they're unauthorized. That's how these cases come to the surface. And I will also say, Mr. Cohen, if you recall, when the Pollard case first broke, there were all kinds of absolute denials on the part of official Israeli spokespeople that they had had anything to do with this initially, that it was any official okay, it was a rogue operation. It was finally admitted that it wasn't a rogue operation. We're seeing that same thing in the Franklin case. Now, that may or may not be, but let the facts speak for themselves.
Yeah. As you know, in the case of Pollard was not operated by Israeli Mossad. It was operated by another service that actually was born in its first incarnation.
But that's splitting hairs. I mean, it was official Israeli government-related activity.
It was an Israeli government activity, but it was not by the Mossad, and actually the Mossad at the time had certain kind of prohibitions about acting in the U.S.
Well, that may be, but sometimes the FBI acts and the CIA doesn't, or the DIA acts and the CIA doesn't. It's still a government operation.
Well, I have to tell you, both Avner and Michael, that I spoke a week or so ago with a former senior CIA official who had just been to Israel to meet with his friends in the Mossad, and his friends in the Mossad told him that they're very distressed about this neoconservative argument and fight that's going on in Washington, the extent to which there's this impression that the neoconservatives have hijacked foreign policy. And the Mossad people told this CIA official or ex-CIA official that they can't get anybody in Washington to take them seriously anymore.
I know.
So there's an irony, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
But
yeah, I agree. And again, I think, obviously, there are all kinds of people in Israel that are very distressed by the Pollard case and by things that happened around the Pollard case, just saying this is going to hurt Israel, shouldn't have been done, and there were people conducting that maybe were off on a rogue kind of assignment, but nonetheless, it happened.
Well, tell me about the I can't remember the acronym for the group that Pollard was working for, but we had a case out here in Los Angeles involving Richard Smyth, who eventually...
Yes, exactly.
FBI did a black bag job on his consulting company out in Canoga Park, and he was in partnership, Smyth, with a very famous movie producer out here who...
Arnon Milchan.
Arnon Milchan, right.
Yeah.
And Smyth, before the FBI could move on him, he disappeared and went to Israel. And then he was recently, I believe, extradited. I think
indeed, I believe he is now... there was some kind of deal that was made with the Justice Department, maybe he's spending a short time in jail, and after that he'll be out of it.
Right.
But that's what I meant. That's why I mentioned your city, Los Angeles, and indeed it was... It was the intelligence body that had been formed ages ago, and it did various kind of organizational changes, bureaucratic changes, but it was had formed a long time ago to support technical information for the Israeli nuclear project. And that was the context of the Smythe story, and I believe that even it was that organization that operated. And it's not clear the nature of the authorization that they had, to what extent the Israeli top political level were fully aware of Israel ultimately took responsibility, because, as Michael said, it was Israeli governmental operation. But it's not clear to this day to what extent the political level actually gave the okay to those people to do what they did.
Well, they took Smyth in, though, didn't they? He became a he was hiding out in Israel for a while.
And then he was extradited from Spain. He spent many years in Spain.
Right.
He was short time in Israel, and then...
Right. And then Arnold Milchan, who had a very successful career here in Hollywood, he's now living in France. I don't know whether that's related at all, whether he's...
Well, I believe that he is at least...
a target.
...citizenship as well as American citizenship,
right.
And he's still very active in Hollywood as well.
Right.
His father was connected with Shimon Peres in the 60s, helping fundraising and other kind of help with the nuclear project. And I think that even in one interview for 60 Minutes, Arnold himself was not too shy to use those kind of credentials.
Right.
So, but here we talk about individuals, about private individuals, not U.S. officials or any governmental officials.
Right. Well, just in closing then, let me ask Michael Sabre, whether you, I mean, I know you had that experience back in the Carter administration, and it's a similar case now with Larry Franklin and supposedly Steve Rosen from AIPAC and others were involved. Do you think that, there is a... do you believe that there is a active Israeli network, which is what I guess is the question here?
Well, I think Mr. Cohen and I would agree that there is, and it's an understandable one in the very reasons that he gave. There is great interest on the part of the Israelis, and their antenna are very high with anything that directly affects them, that the United States has privy information. And consequently, it just gets into this area of either overzealous officials and or private individuals that say, look, Israel is so important for the United States, and the United States is so important for Israel that we're just going to blur these lines more than they should be, or maybe they aren't even blurred. And we have to get to the bottom of that. I think, as I say, when you have all these investigations that have taken place, they should be made public. People should have access to that information. The best we've been able to do in many cases when we apply to the Freedom of Information Act is find out that investigation took place. But if there's nothing there, if all these individuals that you know have had investigations conducted around them about giving information to Israel under some kind of illegality, or there wouldn't be an investigation, let's make them public and let's decide accordingly then.
Well, let me just ask Abner in closing then what he thinks in terms of this, and obviously none of this is particularly good for U.S.-Israeli relations.
No, you're right about that. I agree with Michael up to a point. I think there is a lot of high antennas in both sides. I do not believe they're properly and formally intelligent. I think it's more diplomatic. Sometimes it's blurry, but I do not believe it's under any kind of support of intelligence body. Second, I think Israel is very, very happy the fact that Larry Franklin is not a Jew. Larry Franklin is a Catholic. He is a professional from the intelligence community, and he himself, unlike the case of Steve Bryant, he's not a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Israelis are quite happy about that.
Well, I have to tell you that that the idea that allies don't spy on each other is kind of naive, not to think that they do, because there was a case I'm very familiar with where there was a Soviet double agent working for British intelligence who was the most valuable asset that the Brits had. The CIA was so jealous that Reagan was getting all of his intelligence through Margaret Thatcher that they assigned one of their people to find out who it was that the British were running. And, of course, the guy that they put in charge of the investigation was Aldrich Ames, who ended up giving this up this double agent and causing enormous damage. So there's an example. I have to end now. I thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Abner Cohen and Michael Sabre. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Abner Cohen, who's a visiting professor at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the author of Israel and the Bomb, and a new book, Israel's Last Taboo, and Michael Sabre, who is an international business consultant and the author of The Armageddon Network. This program is produced by Louis Vandenberg, and the engineer is Mark Maxwell, and also assistant producer Carol Coote.